agenda and a number of staff people, so we need to do some switching off. We're going to start with House Bill 3304. Representative Flores, as I know, is here, and then move to House Bill 3631. Is Senator Ringo still here? Okay, sorry. So we're going to be bopping around a little bit here. So, Representative Flores, why don't you come on up? And, Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 3304A requires county registrars to receive death certificates to notify the county clerk of name, age, date of birth, and address of deceased person within 2 business days of receiving the certificate.
All right. Representative Flores, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. First, there is a Dash A2 amendment that you probably should have in your file that changes the 2-day requirement of notification to 5. I have seated with me today Mr. and Mrs. Eugene Schoenheit, and it was at their request that I sponsored this friendly little bill, which helps do some housekeeping on voter registration files in each county. It pares down the sometimes many week requirement to a few days. It helps eliminate the potential for double voting, some of those non-living voters that we all would perish the thought. And also it is, we hope, a cost-effective measure as well. It's very simple, but I would like to have Mr. Schoenheit give you the reasons that they would like to see this bill become law.
Great. Welcome.
Hi. Well, I'm Gene Schoenheit, and this lady on the front here was my mother-in-law, Marie Hester, and she basically brought about this bill. And the reason she brought about this bill is because we kept getting ballots in the mail, you know, for various things, when they moved, when she died, and that type of thing. So I brought, that's basically what inspired the bill. When we researched this, we looked into the problem, and we found that it was taking up to 2 months to get people removed from the voter registration list. Then we looked into why it was taking so long, and basically it was just, the process of going from one department to another, compiling them, piling them up on a desk, and then moving them on. And another point on the 2 months, I've had other people tell me it takes longer, but I haven't been able to prove that. Basically, what House Bill 3304 does, it just cuts the time down. And how it works is the county register in each county office basically makes the death certificate. And within 48 hours of somebody dying, they make a death certificate, and that has to go to the police department, so the local police department knows that, and it goes to county and the local cities. And the idea here was just simply, if they're making a copy, why not just have them make one more copy and send it over to the election department? And that's basically how this, bill came about. This bill will save money, and how it actually saves money is, yes, there's one more step in the, say, county register's office, but if you have a large county where several hundred people a day dying, and or I should say several hundred people per month dying, and if you, say, calculate a couple hundred people times 2 months, that's, up to $400. Well, if you figure out what it costs to send out one of these, it's probably $1 apiece, so basically, the average county, I guess, would probably save about $200 a month on this deal. And the last point that's really important here is that when somebody dies, it would be really nice, for family members if they didn't have, registered a vote showing up in the mail, after they just died. I mean, it's hard on family members when somebody dies, and this would just make a little improvement there, too.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I might add also that, as I understand it in Clackamas County particularly, and I don't know of other counties' procedures, but they do a review of death notices as one way that they go about making notations as far as deaths, and this would eliminate the need to do that if they are in timely and quick receipt of an abstract with the information. And I would also like to thank Senator Corcoran for this front row seat, as he is wont to mention in some of his things.
We haven't got to the hot stuff yet.
Any questions for the panel?
Well,
go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it was Eugene's idea to come up with this bill, but it was my mother who gave the impetus for it. She died May 10th of last year, and it was difficult to get these ballots after she had died. And so we thought it might be good if something could be done about this. She was a Democrat most of her life, so this is not a partisan issue. This is something that could be good for everyone. So I hope you'll consider this. Voting was very important to my mother. She voted every year in every election. So, you know, it would be something that would make her feel good. Thank you.
Thank you. As a candidate myself, I've also called people using lists from the county and have reached people that have, or reached homes where someone's passed away, and it does not put one in a very comfortable position. So we appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Any questions from the panel? Any comments? Thanks for being here. I hope being part of the Oregon legislative process has been a positive experience for you. Thanks. I have Jennifer Woodward is here. Do you need to testify?
No, I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions? I'm going to move into work session on House Bill 3304.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson. Senator Atkinson moves the dash twos to House Bill 3304. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, it's so ordered. Senator Atkinson.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3304 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 3304 to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, it's so ordered. Senator Atkinson, would you like to be the carrier?
Sure.
There you go. So. Only one more hurdle, and that's the governor's office. We'll see what we can do to help you there. Oh, because the amendment. Sorry. Well, I suspect Representative Flores can get through.
Even without the amendment, they would still have to pass the floor.
Well, yeah. Okay, we're going to move into public hearing on House Bill 3631, and I'd like Senator Ringo and Dave Honeycutt to come forward, please.
Talk about an odd couple. My Lord.
Senator Clark, anybody is not.
Madam Chair, could they sit closer together?
Oh, he's actually going to take a thing. Oh, Jason.
We'll try it again.
Hey, fellas. This will be in the next Weekly Democrat, believe me.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, State Senator Charlie Ringo, District 17. House Bill 3631 does two things. One of it relates to adding additional protection for the lands adjacent to Forest Park in Portland, the largest urban park in the country. And the other portion of the bill relates to a specific parcel of property in Multnomah County and would allow the owner of that parcel to subdivide it, notwithstanding other land use regulations. Obviously, there's a compromise involved in bringing these things together, and I'd just like to speak for a second about each one of these separately. First of all, you've got before you 3631. I intend to offer the dash A3 amendments, which all these amendments, the A3 amendments do two things. One is they essentially take out the forest park section and put in an entirely different forest park section that is in accordance with the preference of the city of Portland. And so, and I could go into the details on why they like that better, but just suffice it to say that they think the technicalities of land use laws give this version better protection for the lands adjacent to Forest Park. The other thing that's included in the A3 amendment is that it changes the lots that may be developed on that parcel from 8 lots to 6 lots, and that was part of the compromise that's part of this. I want to just speak for a moment about the second part, which we'll just call the Dorothy English portion, and it allows the woman that's received a lot of press to divide her property. And it is controversial, and there's pros and cons in doing so. And, you know, lots of people come to the legislature claiming special exception or trying to claim why they're a special case. And in this instance, Ms. English purchased her property in 1953, well before our land use laws were in place, and there were certain expectations involved. And I think the length of time by which she's owned the property is some justification for giving her a special exception. Certainly there will be people here testifying against the bill. They will testify against any special exception and note that, you know, we don't want to open the floodgates. And I guess I echo that concern. I don't want this to be, oh, yeah, everybody wants something special done with their land. They can circumvent the land use system by coming to the legislature, and I hope this bill does not lead to that. Nevertheless, I think this is a special case, and it warrants this bill. And I would also say that the 6 parcels is a reasonable compromise, and in the larger context of what we're putting together here, I think it makes sense. So that's my summary, and I'm available for any questions. And just to summarize, I would like the adoption of the A3 amendments.
Thank you. Dave?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Senator Ringo forgot to note. He's actually been to the Dorothy English's property. We've had him, Mrs. English has had him up there, so he's actually seen the property as well. And we certainly agree with Senator Ringo that a special exception is needed here, and we would certainly concur with moving the A3 amendments. I would note, and I talked to Senator Ringo about this just before we got up here, in Section 4. Of the bill, it's page 2 of the A3 amendments. Page 2, lines 13 through 15. That's subsection 3 of section 4. There have been concerns expressed to me by folks who would be considered both my allies and folks that I'm usually on the opposite side of, as to the meaning of that language in subsection 3. And essentially, what the intent there is that if parcels are already zoned for agricultural or forest use, then those particular parcels that zoning in and of itself is sufficient to set to demonstrate compliance with the standards in lines 2 through 8 of page 2 of section 4 of the A3 amendments. But the intent isn't that all property within the area of influence has to be zoned for agricultural or forest purposes. There are lands already around Forest Park that are not in agricultural or forest zoning. They're within the urban growth boundary, and it's certainly not the intent to force Metro or any of the local governments to rezone those properties that are already in the urban growth boundary to agricultural or forest uses.
And I concur with that analysis.
Wow, two lawyers that agree, Madam Chair. That's amazing.
We're not talking about purrs.
Any questions or comments for this panel?
Madam Chair, the only other thing I'd like to say is that Representative Mitch Greenlick has had a huge interest in protecting Forest Park, and he may be in the audience, and I know this is something that he has worked on, and so you may want to ask him to come forward and testify.
Representative Greenlight, do you wish to come forward? Come on up. Never give a politician an opportunity to speak.
Can I make a speech?
No, but we're happy to hear from you about your thoughts on the bill.
Okay. I was the original author of the... I'm sorry, this is I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland, and Forest Park is in my district. I frankly prefer the language in the original version of 3631 you have, and the reason that I prefer that is because I believe Forest Park is a special area of the state. I don't believe it's only a city park or only a local park or even only a metro park. It is quite an extraordinary resource that was first identified by the Clark of Lewis and Clark in his paddle up the Willamette River and identifying that, and he identified it much in the way it is now. So I have no comment on section 5 of the amendment, but on the earlier sections, as I say, I did prefer the original. However, I think section 2, 3, and 4 of this version does give Forest Park protection. Charlie said one of the lessons of politics for a freshman is to declare victory wherever you can find it, and I think this kind of protection, recognizing Forest Park and getting the local governments to recognize it, is something that's useful. So while I prefer the other version, this version is acceptable, and I have no comments at all on Section 5.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, I know you're probably here on House Bill 3613. Do you have a few minutes that you can wait so we can finish up? Thank you, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Taking advice from Senator Ringo does do some harm to his credibility, Chair, but other than that, it was fine.
Madam Chair and Senator Corcoran, he's my senator, and I'm his constituent, so I'm sure as a constituent he would never give me bad advice.
My condolences.
I have Susan Muir, Randy Tucker, and Art Schlapp.
Not Schlock, it's Slack.
Schlack, I know.
I mean, Slack.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and committee members. My name is Susan Muir. I'm the interim planning director for Multnomah County.
What appropriate name for a planning person.
Yes. I'm here today. I've submitted a letter to you. I've also brought a letter from Commissioner Rojo De Steffi from the Multnomah County Board, and I'm here today to let you know that the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners opposes this bill. Multnomah County has a history of doing community-based rural land use plans over the last 8 years. These plans have taken years to create with intensive public involvement, public hearings, adoption by the Board of County Commissioners, and acknowledgement by the state. For each of these plans, the county has mailed individual notice to all property owners potentially affected and invited them to attend each public meeting and participate on or with the Citizen Advisory Committee for each plan. The effects of the language in the Dorothy English section of the bill, as proposed, would essentially undo the work Multnomah County has done with citizens over the last 8 years in building land use plans. I'll remind you that statewide planning goal 1 calls for the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. The language as proposed would reduce the already limited supply of forest land in Multnomah County. Multnomah County values the contribution forest management makes to the diversity of the industrial economy of the county and of the state. Protection of the forest land base also helps to support jobs in rural areas of Multnomah County and our adjacent counties. This proposal would convert land the county has found suitable for small-scale commercial forestry into small rural residential parcels that tend not to be managed for forest products. It would also encumber nearby forest lands by allowing new dwellings within a commercial forest management environment. The conflicts between dwellings and forest managers in this state are well known. No detailed analysis has been done about how many additional lots this would create or how many parcels could come under this bill as proposed. Multnomah County has ownership data electronically back to 1977, and we've done the search and we know that it's more than one back to 1977. We don't know how many it is back to 1955 as the language proposed. There are unknown impacts to infrastructure services, and there are also conflicts with statewide planning goal 14. I'd be available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Not we sure. Also entered the record a letter from Commissioner Maria Rojo De Steffi. Senator Corcoran.
I guess the concern I have, Ms. Mayor, is the fact that this was property that was owned and purchased long before we had land use laws. So I'm a little concerned about the personal property aspect of this when I understand that people shouldn't come in, you know, and circumvent land use laws. They've already purchased land. We've got an issue like this in Cottage Grove right now with a auto racing thing, and it's been around since 1957, and all these people that moved here from California 5 years ago are angry about the noise. And it's like, you know, caveat emptor. So I'm a little concerned that the county would be weighing in on this when it was property that was owned before land use.
Chair Brown and Senator Corcoran, Multnomah County regulates all property in unincorporated rural Multnomah County, regardless of the date of ownership. And the state statutes and rules give us the authority to apply zoning to property that was purchased before zoning went into effect and after zoning went into effect. The ability to do 20-year, 30-year, 40-year comprehensive plans affects an entire community, and therefore we look comprehensively at all of the parcels and all of the zoning and apply it consistently throughout the county. In order to address the concern that you've raised, what we do is just do a good job of providing notice to people to give them a heads up that things may be changing or to participate in the process so that they can weigh in and tell us how they'd like to see their community grow and develop or remain as a natural resource area. And so we try very hard to do that. And in the rural area plan over the West Hills, which is where this property is located, we did send notice to every single property owner at the time we were doing our local plans, asking people to come and participate in our process so that we could, at a local level, make the plans of how we wanted to see this area develop and grow.
But, Madam Chair, don't you have the ability also, didn't you have the ability as Multnomah County to make the adjustments that this lady had asked for?
Chair Brown and Senator Corcoran, if I understand your question, you're asking me if Multnomah County could have allowed 6 lots to be developed on this particular property. And there is a process in the state rules that allow for exceptions to statewide planning goals to be applied for. There hasn't been one in this case for us to evaluate whether or not it's worthy and meets the criteria that everyone else in the state meets to get an exception to the statewide planning goals.
Thank you. Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. Before I begin, I guess I have a question for Senator Atkinson about who that picture is going to be easier to use to blackmail, Charlie or Dave.
It's actually to keep away the pests at his house.
I'd like to, 1000 Friends of Oregon opposes House Bill 3631, the -3 or -4 amendments. I forget which one you're being asked to adopt, but they are identical. And I would add that we do not have a position on sections 1 through 4 of the bill, the Forest Park elements of the bill. We do oppose section 5 of the bill, and therefore we oppose the bill as a whole for two reasons. First, as has been mentioned, I believe, by Senator Ringo, we believe it seriously undermines Oregon's land use program for the legislature to pass bill after bill addressing specific local issues that affect individual landowners. The legislature, in our view, ought to be setting broad policy for the state. We have concerns when the legislature reaches down to the local level to rezone particular properties or to specify the location of particular urban growth boundaries or other things that that we're seeing more and more frequently. Second, we oppose the specific provisions of Section 5, which would order Multnomah County to allow, in this case, a specific landowner, but possibly many specific landowners, to be able to subdivide their forest land for large lot dwellings. Obviously, this provision was crafted with one landowner in mind, and we've done a little bit of research on this landowner, Mrs. English, as she's been mentioned already. She and her husband, I guess, first purchased this property for $4,500 in 1953. They later subdivided and sold half the property, which was originally about 39 acres, and it's now approximately 20 acres. The remaining 20 acres were assessed in 2000 to have a value of approximately $200,000, and I assume that at least...
Per acre for the entire
total,
property?
Total. No, it would not be $200,000 per acre. That would be a lot. I assume the value is even higher now. This does not include the value of the house. It's only the land, Madam Chair. It doesn't include anything that the landowners would have received for the sale of the other 19 acres of their property either. So assuming that the cost of the portion of the original parcel that was not subdivided and sold was approximately half of the original cost, about $2,250, excuse me, then the value of the current property has increased over 80 times from its original cost. And even if you take inflation into account, the value of the property is currently about 14 times greater than its original cost to the landowners. So with this in mind, and understanding that much of the land was sold before the land use laws went into effect, and also understanding that the landowners owned the land for 25 years before the land use laws or the zoning was changed on their property, or something like 25 years, in our view, there's not a particularly compelling fairness issue at stake in this case. So with that in mind, I'll stop and see if there are any questions.
Art, you want to go ahead?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Art Slock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here today to express a concern to you with respect to Section 4 of the original bill as it relates to an individual piece of property. Our concern is, and I think those of you that have been around a few sessions know that each session the legislature is asked to almost be a planning commission and to make a decision on individual pieces of property based on hardship and other kinds of issues. This is one of those. There are a number of other bills that are in the legislature that are also asking for special consideration by the legislature when they have the opportunity to go through the local land use planning process. I think if the local land use planning process that has been established is going to have credibility, those issues should be addressed at the local level, and that the legislature should refrain from going down a slippery slope to approve individual requests. Once you establish that precedence, I would anticipate that you will continue to get a number of requests from individuals asking for the same consideration, and I'm not sure where you draw the line at that point. But that is our concern, Chair Brown and members of the committee. We think this does set a precedence, which we are very concerned about.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for this panel? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Next up, Bob Rindy and Ron Eber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me today is Ron Eber, our farm forest specialist. And we are here to, I think, in part to ask some questions, but also to raise concern with a bill that would, as you've just heard, essentially apply in part to a single parcel of land. And I think that precedent is one that concerns us, because I believe it will indeed lead to many more such proposals, and we've already seen several this session. There are two parts to this bill, and the first part applies to Forest Park or areas around it, and presumably other parcels or other parks, but I don't know of any others. The question that we have concerns how a city or county is supposed to comply with this. And I think the answer to that, and I'm looking at the dash threes, I understand they're the same as the dash fours, and I'm looking at line 13 on page 2 through 15, 13 through 15, and trying to understand whether what this bill will ask of, say, Metro and local jurisdictions is that they either must zone the park and lands within 2 miles encircling that park as farm forest, or whether they have the option of doing that. And I wanted to raise a concern with both of those. First of all, it's not clear to me whether that's the intent, whether they have to or whether they shall, whether they may. If they have to, the concern would be, in part, that some of that land is already within the metro urban growth boundary, and is probably zoned, as is required under LCDC's rules, for urban uses. And, in fact, as you've probably heard, the debate on putting land into the metro urban growth boundary is fast and furious. It's very important that when land gets in there, it is available for, in many cases, very intensive urban uses, because that is the need in that region to accommodate the population that they predict. So I don't know what happens to those lands if this passes. Lands that LCDC just very recently approved metros under Metro's plan for urban zoning, that potentially now either could be rezoned in spite of LCDC's rules or must be rezoned for farm forest. And I think the bill is unnecessary if the intent is to protect lands that are already in the park. I can't think of a case where something like Forest Park is going to be zoned anything other than open space. And so if the intent is to protect Forest Park, we don't need this bill. If the intent is to protect the residential use that's already surrounding us, up to 2 miles around Forest Park, it's first of all unclear, and second of all, I think unwarranted to simply force that into a farm forest designation when it may indeed be very important to accommodate growth in that boundary. As for the second piece of this bill, starting in Section 5, I'm going to turn it over to Ron to indicate some of the concerns we have with that and perhaps some of the questions we might also have.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Farm Forest Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. A couple of points on Section 5. We would reiterate that this does, in our mind, would set a precedent for trying to draft an amendment that obviously is attempting to have one particular property get an additional development right than the current rules would allow, although without further analysis, it's hard to say whether other properties might also qualify. And that's a slippery slope, as has been mentioned, to go down, because then other people will come forward and say, well, you did it in that situation, why not in my situation? If I might, the legislature, though, has in the past addressed not specific properties but certain situations that arise on properties to deal with the kind of issues that Senator Corcoran mentioned with regard to change in the rules. In 1993, House Bill 3661 did develop a lot of record law that recognized that property rules have changed as of the acknowledgement of the comprehensive plans in 1985 and allowed for a long-term landowner to get a dwelling. There was also a bill last session from Senator Beyer that dealt with parcels in forest zones that had multiple dwellings that had been there for years and years and allowed those to be divided off. But I'm not aware of any bill where a particular parcel has been granted or we've tried to recognize a partitioning or subdividing right. Oregon law has not recognized the ability to divide land as an existing use with any grandfather rights. So with that, I would end my testimony.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for this group? Thank you. At this point in time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3631. I'm not going to open a work session. Is Dave Honeycutt still in the room? Senator Ringo somewhere around? I have concerns about lines 13 through 15 on page 2 of the dash A3 amendments. We have talked, and make sure you can get those technically correct before we move forward on the bill. Thank you. We'll bring that one back as soon as you guys get that worked out. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3613. Jim, that's one of the bills you're working. I'm going to ask Representative Greenleck, Harvey Matthews, and Kate Richardson to come forward.
Well,
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, House Bill 3613 requires the Oregon Investment Council to invest in emerging growth businesses in Oregon. You have the Dash 5 amendment, which the description of it is included in your summary. Among other things, it changes the required level of investment to be at least $100 million.
Okay. Are there two sets of amendments? Just one.
You have the Dash 5s. Previously, we distributed the Dash 2s. I think that the Dash 5s eclipse the Dash 2s, okay. But I'm not sure.
All right. Harvey, take it away.
All right. Well, we have been working very diligently with your staff, Celia, and the Treasurer's Office staff and Representative Greenlick's staff to develop a set of amendments that everybody can live with. Basically, what's been done is there's been parts taken out, including the 1% discussion that has been eliminated at the request of the Treasurer's Office. The look first at all Oregon investments has been eliminated and instead focused just on venture capital investments. And the $100 million floor has been kept with certain safety clauses included. Also included is a section to deal with the Oregon growth account issue. As you know, in Special Session 6, as was commonly referred to, the money from the Oregon growth account that wasn't committed was taken to balance the budget, and this last section in the bill, not last, but Section 8. All right. 6 deals with an accounting measure that helps restore their funding so that they can invest in Oregon opportunities.
Great.
So with that,
Representative Greenlick, any further comments?
Yes, I do. Madam Chair, Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm really very happy to be here for you with this bill. We've worked this since February, and in the original version that came over from the House on the House floor, we promised to make amendments that would move this towards consensus. It passed on the House floor with that promise, and we've been working with your staff very, very closely to make sure we keep the original intention of the bill in place, and that bill is to stimulate the Oregon Investment Council to look first at Oregon opportunities to create venture capital funds in Oregon to help small and other venture capital companies stay here in Oregon and create the jobs we need for it, but to still both assure the unions that we're not doing anything, we're not recommending anything imprudent, so that they feel comfortable that their pension funds are secure, and we now have our understanding that all the unions are supporting this bill, and to secure the confidence of the treasurer that we're not asking the treasurer and the investment council to do things that are uncomfortable to them. We think we have achieved that, and we think also adding the Oregon growth account amendments, which allows the cash flow from the Oregon growth account into the hands of the OGA board, so that they can commit investments even before funding them. They're not allowed to commit it until they have cash in hand, and this allows them a smoother way of investing funds they have available in OGA. So I'm very pleased with the outcome. I support the Dash 5s, and I really want to commend your staff, Senator Brown, for working with this and helping achieve this consensus.
Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff, Oregon State Treasury. I'm just here to echo the comments of Representative Greenlick and Harvey Matthews. We have worked a lot on this bill. As you know, the overarching objective of the state investment funds is to have as high a return as possible to make these funds as productive as possible, subject to the prudent standard. And we think that as this bill stands now, we can achieve the goal of the new methodology of looking first at Oregon for venture capital opportunities and still maintain that objective of as high of productive funds as possible. And this would be primarily looking at the PERS fund. And so the high returns, as high returns as possible, is a very important piece of that. And we believe that there are enough safeguards in here that it will not compromise the productivity. And there is a reporting, I think Harvey mentioned this, there is a reporting aspect to this bill as well.
Great. I would like to thank each and every one of you. I know you all put in a lot of time for making this be a collaborative product, and I really appreciate that. I know Celia Nunez, C. Desiree, Randall's chief deputy, Linda. What is her last name?
Haggard.
Okay. So anyway, you guys did a great job, and thank you very much. We appreciate
your
time.
She's working the Lang Center before she did that.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
I want to see that the unions are okay with this. I want some heads to be nodding.
Yeah, they're fine. They're fine.
All right.
Madam Chair, if I may, just to give a little further explanation on the OGA piece. As you know, that the OGA shares the same goal of investing in venture capital. All this does is a permissive action we don't anticipate is going to be used very often, but we are very cognizant of not. It has pretty strict parameters on it. It's limited to a fiscal year, that sort of thing. So we're being very cautious about not diverting any other funds.
We'll look forward to a glowing report next session. Thank you. Any questions, any comments for this group? We're currently in work session, and Senator Burdick has moved the Dash 5 amendments. Is there any objection to the Dash 5 amendments? Any objections to the Dash 5 amendments? Hearing none, the bill is amended. Senator Burdick.
Use it for the next
hostile. To the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation as amended.
Jenny.
What?
Mm-hmm. Senator Burdick has moved House Bill 3613 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, it is so passed, and I'll carry the bill. Thanks, guys. Good job.
What are they going to do? Things just got nothing to do with our.
Are we ready to go on 139? Do we know?
139.
You need to move anything with me. I have a committee at 3.
Okay. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 139. I know folks are waiting for another bill, but.
I know on 3328. We're going to run out of time here. I want to see where we are on Senate Bill 139. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Co-Chair, Senate Bill 139 is the bill that doubles the fees for space in the voter's pamphlet, establishes an election operating account within the Office of Secretary of State. You have the Dash 5, which is our best attempt to find something to displease everyone on the committee. It replaces the bill. It decreases the size of candidate statements and arguments. It increases the prices for election candidate spaces. It imposes a sliding scale fee for voters' pamphlet measure arguments. And it deletes the requirements that maps and party precinct worker descriptions be included in the statewide voters' pamphlet. It requires that the measure text be included in the voter's pamphlet, so it's different from previous amendments that you have seen. And it still requires the Secretary of State to post the voter's pamphlet information electronically and respond to requests for documents. What it doesn't contain was from the Dash 4s. There was a sunset requirement on that, and it retains the original of the Dash 2 fee changes.
Okay. So we have some technical amendments.
I should say also that there is a technical, what we would call a conceptual amendment that we've talked with Legislative Council about removing four lines and renumbering. And I think the Secretary of State has distributed a description of that. If you wish to adopt the dash fives, we would ask that you do it with the conceptual note.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Just to clarify, the text of the of ballot measures would be in the voter's pamphlet under this version.
Yes, the dash five amendment, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Burdick, includes the text. It requires that the text be printed. We estimate that there would be an average of 1 to 2 pages extra in the voter's pamphlet for each of the measures.
Mr. Stembridge, the deletion of the operating account, the evolving account, how would that work in terms of technically? I'm assuming the goal of this was that there for it to be some flexibility in the Secretary of State's office so that if there were dollars left over from the primary, those could be used to fund the voter's pamphlet in the general.
Madam Co-Chair, this would leave it up to the Legislative Assembly to do it through the general fund. Revenue that comes in for voters' pamphlet space would go into the general fund, and the Secretary of State would need a general fund money in order to create the voters' pamphlet.
So
appropriation.
If the legislature cannot agree on a general fund, what would happen in terms of the Secretary of State's ability to move forward with the voters' pamphlet without the operating account?
You'd have to ask the Secretary of State specifically on that. My understanding is that it would jeopardize the existence of a voter's pamphlet.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Right now, there's not a separate account. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the whole purpose of having a separate account is that you're trying to get accountability, so you know that the amount coming in is the amount that it's paying for itself.
Correct.
And that's a very easy method of getting that kind of accountability. I guess I would definitely prefer to see that separate account in the bill. I don't know if I'd kill it over that, but I'd strongly prefer to see that.
Senator Beyer.
I was just curious about the technical amendment. Are we deleting lines 17 and 18 because we don't need to say the full text measure has to be on the web, or they don't want to put it there?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, that's correct. The when we asked for the dash 5 amendment, we said we wanted the text back in, and the drafters didn't take that part out that says that they'll be included in the information that is posted by the Secretary of State. It will still be in both. It will be in the voter's pamphlet, and it will be posted. We just don't need to have it specified that they post it, because it's already going to be included in the voter's pamphlet. So it's just not needed.
Okay. Senator Beyer, I think you have a constitutional problem with your amendments at this point in time. Okay. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 139. And open a public hearing on 3328.
Roger, we're going to need some guarantee that there is a general fund allocation in the budget if they're not willing to do an operating account. So, yeah.
Hi, how are you? Representative Flores, come on up. Thanks for being patient with us. Okay. I'm going to have the committee staff to do a brief overview of the bill before you get started, if you don't mind. Go ahead.
Ms. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3328, as a result of a work group that met and dealt with a number of issues that have come up regarding the Oregon GSPC, Government Standards and Practices Committee, does a number of things. I'll try to go down them as fast as I can without making them clear. First, it allows a public official paid by a nonprofit to take official action that may benefit the nonprofit. It allows a public official or their relative to receive something of value from a person without legislative or administrative interest. It lifts the $100 gift cap for a relative of a public official regarding food, beverages, entertainment, lodging, payment of travel expenses when the relative is traveling with a public official on official business. It allows a public official to make salary recommendations regarding their own salary or a relative's salary. It allows the regulation of non-monetary benefits to officials, such as use of publicly owned equipment or vehicles, cell phones, frequent flyer miles. If were filed against a candidate within 61 days of the election, the measure would allow the investigation to be delayed until after the election. It prohibits the GSPC from fining a public body if the body was acting upon advice of counsel. It directs the commission to adopt standards or interpretations of law by rule rather than just written opinion. It allows the GSPC to issue a letter of reprimand in lieu of a penalty. It requires all paid lobbyists to register with the DSPC no more than 5 business days after they agree to provide services for pay or expense reimbursement, or they exceed current limits of 24 hours or $100 per quarter, and requires electronic recording of executive sessions.
Thanks, Jan. Those are the highlights.
Welcome. Those Representative Flores, go ahead. Thanks for being patient while we were working through some other measures.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, and for the record, I am Linda Flores, representative for House District 51. I'm here primarily before you today to testify as the House Rules member, Rules Committee member, who had been chair of the work group of numbers of entities who had brought approximately 9 House bills, and as a result of, it was either 6 or 7 consecutive meetings, we came with to consensus and developed this omnibus bill, which accomplishes much of what you just heard. Our goal was to drive to consensus to find something that was a common sense solution to some of the concerns that have developed over time with some changes in legislation, and to allow local entities to pick up and make rules that addressed concerns that were better handled in local situations. And those individuals are here to testify to their specific concerns and how they were addressed and the agreements that were reached. And I thank you for your time, and I know that they can better address the questions that you might have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
They're going to bring up amendments. Sarah Weatherson, she's from the Money and Politics Research Group.
So I could have a couple, right?
They're all going to.
Sarah Witherspoon?
They're both going to.
These three are posing their names.
I think everybody's posing their names.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Sarah Weatherson, and I'm the Research and Outreach Associate with the Money and Politics Research Action Project, which is also called MIPRAP, and you're receiving some -6 amendments that I'll be speaking to today. Janice Thompson has talked with many of you. She's our executive director and sends her apologies for not being here today as she had a scheduling conflict. So you get the second stringer. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about House Bill 3328, which is a good bill, and it takes important steps to clarify the role of the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and we just want to offer a few suggestions in the form of -6 amendments to make it stronger. We have 4 basic changes to propose today, addressing what we like to call the safe harbor provision, the single mom provision, the if not but provision, and the go directly to Marion County Court provision. The safe harbor provision it's good, certainly, to protect public bodies from taking action on basis of a body's legal counsel, and we just like to add the word written to the advice that they get. The single mom provision, we applaud the intent of the bill's crafters to allow single moms to take their minor children with them on overnight trips to informational sessions sponsored by lobbyists, and we understand how this will help firefighters also bring their spouses along to appreciation dinners and that sort of thing. We want to be sure that the pool of people eligible to attend such events with a public official remains manageable, and we ask the committee to adopt a change from relative to spouse or minor child. The if not but provision, it changes, as
The changes in the Ayen-Gross bill before you take limits on gifts to public officials from one extreme to another by opening the door to unlimited gifts as long as the source of the gift, quote, could not reasonably be known to have a legislative or administrative interest, end quote. This vague standard will be difficult to regulate, and we suggest a less confusing limit of $100 regardless, which would retain the existing gift ban limit for elected officials while allowing grateful citizens to show appreciation to public servants like firefighters. And then lastly, to go directly to court provision, another bill that was in the package of bills that the working group addressed in drafting this bill included provisions that would allow the GSPC to decrease its legal costs. And we have included these provisions here as new sections in the Dash 6 amendments. Currently, public officials and lobbyists have the option of appealing their disputes with a GSPC directly to Marion County Court after the initial investigation instead of going before a central pool of hearing officers, which is standard procedure with other state agencies. Again, I thank you for this opportunity, and I'll be glad to take a stab at any questions you might have.
Thank you, Sarah. Any questions?
Senator.
Senator Burdick.
Just to clarify, the Dash 6 amendments were drafted for the Money and Politics organization?
That's correct.
Thank you.
I have a question. They're dated the 17th, and yet we were just now handed them. Did you not get them prior to this date?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I apologize. It's a procedural thing that I wasn't aware of. And
okay. I'm sure you weren't. I know that not everyone's aware of the process, but when you have 11 pages of amendments,
I'm sorry,
you can't listen to testimony and look at amendments at the same time, so it's really to your benefit to get them in sooner, but I understand that you didn't know. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I mispronounced your name. Genoa and Ron Downs, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Genoa Ingram with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We were part of the work group that was formed on the House side because we were responsible for approximately three or four of the bills that were brought forward. I would like to begin my testimony by first acknowledging and thanking Representative Flores. Before this bill came up, I had not had the opportunity to work with her, and I just want to say for the record that I truly appreciate the way in which the work group was handled and managed. After the work group was formed, it became clear that there were other individuals with additional issues that needed to be addressed, and Representative Flores welcomed those individuals into the work group, and we were able to discuss the issues in depth and come to a solution to those problems. I know one of them was a co-op from Eastern Oregon had an issue that was identified, and we were able to address that, and there were a couple of others. The bill did pass out of the committee unanimously. There were two no votes, as I recall, on the House floor. I just wanted to address some of the issues that the Special Districts Association had. As you may know, the Special Districts represents, for example, sewer and water districts, library districts, fire districts, and a host of other districts. What's difficult, and particularly in my area, is becoming increasingly difficult to find people who will run for these district director positions. For example, where I am in Polk County, we have not been able to find anyone to run for the cemetery district. These people serve without compensation, and if they make a technical error when they are in a meeting, they are held personally liable and personally responsible for the civil penalties, even though they may not benefit monetarily from their error, they're still held personally liable. And our attorney, Mr. Downs, I'm sure will want to address that. Some of the other areas that we were concerned about, did relate to the issue of whether or not there is a legislative or administrative interest. Now, initially, we were the ones who brought to the table the bill that said, let's mirror the $100 cap where there is no legislative or administrative interest. And the group did discuss it in depth, and they said, look, you know, why would we want to be more strict on individuals who are not voting on your issue? For example, I'll use the example of a volunteer firefighter. Why would you want to be more strict on that person than you would a legislator or some other public official who actually will be voting on one of your issues? And so for that reason, the work group, after a thorough and open discussion, felt that if there was no legislative or administrative interest, there really was no reason for the cap to exist, and that is reflected in the bill. Another portion of the bill is found on page 4, lines 21 through 32, section F. And this is actually these are the types of cases that actually receive the most press. The cell phone cases, the frequent flyer miles. There was a case where Marion County wanted to write in their ordinance that part of their benefits package for their employees was that they could use their cell phones for a minimal amount of time, and that would be part of their benefits. That was found not to withstand the test for government standards and practices. And I want to acknowledge, too, the attitude that the commission had. We had their chair, Dave Moss, participating in the work group, and also another of their members. And we were surprised to find out that they really didn't want to deal with things which we referred to as the minutiae. They didn't want to deal with the cell phones, the frequent flyer miles, the dog leg trips, all of that. They wanted to focus their resources on enforcing the open meetings laws and to make sure that public officials were not using their position for financial gain. They felt that so long, and this was the criteria that they insisted on having in the bill, so long as there was official action by a public body that would adopt this type of criteria, you may use your cell phone or you may use your public vehicle for a minimal amount of usage, that can be part of your benefits package. They felt that as long as there was official action taken, that should be okay for the public body to adopt. And that is also reflected in the bill. We brought forward another bill that had to do, it was a direct result of findings by the commission that, and I'll use the example of a police chief or a fire chief or a city manager, if that individual were to make a budget or hand in a budget and it contained their own salary, that was initially considered a conflict of interest because they were recommending their salary increase, perhaps, within that budget, and that was considered using your office for financial gain. Now, there was a later ruling where that opinion was overturned, but there was still enough concern among a number of our members where they still kept those types of officials out of the budgeting process. So the bill also addresses that. You've already heard the portion about quieting complaints that are made just prior to an election. I think the commission will want to address that, but the commission often felt that it was being used during the election season to sling mud at candidates, and they wanted to make sure that the commission wasn't used in that fashion. With regard to the safe harbor for the public officials, there already is a safe harbor provision if a public body goes into executive session and on advice of their legal counsel. However, this would broaden that. So if somebody had a question, a procedural question, they called their attorney, or if their attorney was present at the meeting and was asked, you know, may we go forward with this action? If they are told, yes, you may, we just did not believe that body should be held personally liable for any penalty resulting out of that advice. And again, a safe harbor provision that we felt would keep these people from being, you know, hung out to dry if they make a technical error. the law was also unclear as to whether or not the Government Standards and Practices Commission had any other option other than to levy a civil penalty. And so for that reason, we asked that letters of reprimand be recognized in the statute. There were some conversations prior to this bill and prior to the session with regard to what penalties were available. And we had been told by the commission staff that there was no other option other than to fine. And so we're just asking, we initially talked about a menu approach. If it's your first offense, you get a letter or a warning. And if it persisted, then you would get some sort of civil penalty. But what we ended up doing was just recognizing in statute that a letter of reprimand was a tool that could be used by the commission. We were requested by the commission several provisions that we thought were reasonable. Number one, and we worked with the Capital Club on this particular one, we already thought that compensated lobbyists had to be registered with Government Standards and Practices, and I think most of us in the work group were a little bit surprised to find out that you could be a compensated lobbyist and not have to register, and so that is addressed in the statute as well. One of the things that the commission wanted to see as a tool was the recording of executive sessions. As you probably know, when a public body goes into executive session, they are required to post the notice that they are going to be discussing a specific topic. If they stray from that topic, that is a violation because it is supposed to be done under public scrutiny and with notice, and if it's not, then they open themselves up for investigation. The problem is the commission has a difficult time proving whether or not that occurred if there are not tapes provided. We acquiesced to that. That was something that caused us a little bit of heartburn, but we felt it was fair so long as the tapes were returned to the public body following the investigation. And the commission agreed, and they felt that was fair also. And finally, probably one of the other points that I needed to mention was that the commission also asked that if a public official's relative, and that the term relative is already defined in statute, if a relative receives something of value, then they have to report it just like the public official would. And we agreed that that should be open to public scrutiny if something of value is received. Again, I just wanted to say how much I appreciated the process and working with the commission members and the other participants of the work group. If you'd like, I would prefer to answer questions after Mr. Downs testifies, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, General. Mr. Brown, go ahead and put your name on the record.
Thank you, Chair Clarno. For the record, my name is Ron Downs. I'm
Sorry about that. That's
okay.
I'm not doing too well today.
That's quite all right. I'm a general counsel at Special Districts Association of Oregon. I was asked to come up and testify regarding volunteerism and the status of volunteers in my experience with our board members who serve on the number of special districts throughout the state who are members of SDAO. Just for your information, there's approximately 1,000 special districts, which catches a lot of people by surprise. They're surprised how many actual special districts exist throughout the state. With that, with the average of about, five board members per district, we're running about 4,000 to 5,000 board members. And we face at special districts the same issue that the League of Oregon Cities, that the folks at City County Insurance Services, training. And with all the number of board members who come on, it's not uncommon for them to come on and not know the rules and regulations regarding executive sessions. They don't have proper training, the proper experience, and we do everything we can to get them that training. But be that as it may, we just can't touch all the folks across the state. Over the past few years, I've had to, I've defended a few of these board members who've had GSPC complaints filed against them, and the complaints themselves are more what I call technical violations, the failure to provide notice of an executive session, or once they go into a proper executive session, they sway from the topic into other matters. And in the course of negotiating settlements on these cases, there was a monetary component. Now, albeit it was a small monetary component, but it was a small it was a monetary component that was, I want to say forced, but it was negotiated as part of the settlement with these individual board members personally. there's where my concern is where you have these board members, they were caught by surprise. In many cases, or in the cases that I dealt with, I was unable to see any evidence where there was an intent to violate the executive session statute. It was simply an error in judgment and a misunderstanding of the law. And a real concern about having to pay a monetary fine for what they view was a technical violation, and they're not gaining monetarily from it. And, you know, equally of concern to me was protecting our volunteers and maintaining the volunteer board members that we are able to obtain. And that was a concern of mine. And what I want to share with you, if it'd be okay, is a decision. The Supreme Court, some time ago, Justice Denneke, in a case that, it was a different kind of a case. It was not a GSPC kind of case. It had to do with defamation and slander and comments made by board members during the course of a board meeting and whether they could be held liable. And what the Supreme Court said, which I think really plays into protecting volunteers in the Doris scenario here, and if it would be okay, I'd like to read it. It's quite short. And this is just the name of the case, is for the record, is Noble versus Turniak, Oregon Supreme Court case. Uncompensated citizens serving at least in part to fulfill their civic responsibility comprise the vast bulk of numerous legislative bodies in Oregon. Port commissions, city councils, school boards, and special service districts are some of these bodies. Oregon prides itself on its citizen participation. These bodies make economic, social, educational, and other important decisions. The system will function only if capable people are willing to serve on these bodies. We are of the opinion that a substantial number of capable people would be reluctant to serve if their statements made in the course of their legislative duties were only conditionally privileged. It goes on. We are also of the opinion that persons who would be willing to serve would be hesitant to bring information to the attention of their legislative bodies if the publication were only conditionally privileged. Now, granted, it dealt with a different issue, but I think the point that I want to share with you is that at least our Supreme Court feels that to be a volunteer in Oregon is something quite precious, and we need to do whatever we can to protect those individuals. And what I run into personally is hesitancy to want to serve on these boards if they could be held personally liable for committing what they call technical violations, which gets me to the specific part of the bill dealing with civil penalties. I really do support providing the commission the tool to have a formal letter of reprimand. I think that'll go a long ways to not scaring off people that want to continue to participate and volunteer on boards. That's safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. Any questions of Mr. Downs or Genoa? Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Christy Monson and Candace Haynes.
Hi. We apparently have an agreement on 9-3. We went through it today. We can bring up these items.
Okay.
After these two, so the remainder over.
For the record, my name is Christy Munson, representing the League of Oregon Cities. With me today is Candace Haynes. She's city attorney from the city of McMinnville. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
You're welcome.
We have a few short points that we'd like to make. The first of which is we'd like to thank Representative Flores, Chair Doyle, and the members of the GSPC for their cooperation in this omnibus bill. It truly was a group effort, and without the GSPC, it wouldn't have been as easy and as collegial as it was. Very briefly, and to be clear, we are not here to ask you to dilute or slacken the ethics laws in any way, shape, or form. The League of Oregon City's Board of Directors actually had a conversation on this matter, and we support the absolute highest ethical standards that we could have in Oregon. As a matter of fact, in many situations, cities impose higher ethical standards upon their people than the state does. Very quickly, what's the problem here? Good law should do two things, and the ethics law does not do those two things. Good law should be clear and unambiguous. It should not be confusing. The ethics law has been piecemealed to death by amendments, and is no longer clear, so this fixes that. And two, good law should aid in preventing future ethics violations. This does not do that. So public servants who are volunteers and who want to do a good job don't know what the rules are, and that we can't abide by that. Or people need to know what the rules are. City attorneys, municipal law experts don't know what the rules are regarding ethics. So this changes that. We hope it clarifies it. Lastly, this bill does have a bit of an economic impact. The GSPC has been spending a lot of time investigating and trying cell phone issues, minutia issues, and that will take that out of the GSPC realm and into the city realm, where we feel that we can deal with it as a management issue. It sounds as if we've lobbied you on the bill. You've heard about the details. I don't need to go into them. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them. And with that, I'll give it to Candace Haynes. She'll talk a little bit about some of the legal fine points. And then we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, and welcome.
Thank you very much. Co-Chairs Brown and Clarnot and members of the committee, my name is Candace Haynes. I am the city attorney for the city of McMinnville. I have been a municipal lawyer for almost 25 years now. And
lucky you.
It's wonderful. I love it. I wouldn't do any other thing.
You have a lot of friends that are actuaries and accountants. And
I try to keep my friendships to a minimum so I don't have to worry about what they do for a living. First of all, I would like to echo the thanks that everybody has already expressed for the work group, and particularly for Representative Flores. That work group was a miracle. I don't know how we got that much accomplished and came to that many negotiated settlements in such a short time, but it was just a fabulous working group. I'd also like to just touch on a couple of things about the bill itself. And those who have heard me speak before have heard this sort of ad nauseum, but I call the ethics law as it exists today a trap for the wary. I get questions constantly from employees at the city of McMinnville saying, I've read the law, I can't understand it. And I probably a good third of the time have to say, you know, I don't really understand it either. It's not clear. Even when you look at some of the decisions, it's very hard to find where the dividing line is. So when the League of Oregon City started participation in this bill, we just really aimed for three things that at least that's what I was thinking, and I think that Christy would agree with me. We wanted clarity, we wanted fairness, and we wanted practicality. We didn't want to dilute ethics by any means, but we did want to make it so that anybody could understand it and people could actually follow the law and not have to worry about do I have it right or not. We wanted effective management of our own resources. We felt that we could keep a state standard for ethics that no one would be able to go beneath, but that we would also have a community standard for community resources, so that when something truly was a City of McMinnville thing, the City of McMinnville could control it with City of McMinnville values and City of McMinnville morals. And I think that that's what this group came up with through the negotiation process and through several compromises. And I think it's a very, very good bill as it has been amended.
Great. Any questions or comments? Senator Burdick.
Have you had a chance to look at the A6 amendments?
Actually, co-chairs and Senator Burdick, we got those about 5 minutes before the meeting started. We have done a quick hand-engrossed version, but we haven't done any long or legal analysis of the amendments.
Okay. I appreciate knowing what your impression of it. I should have asked the previous panel as well.
Would you like me to address at least the one point that we did have a chance to discuss quickly was the safe harbor provision that was discussed? Would it assist you if I talked a little bit about that? My concern about that is that most of the ethics-related advice that is given to a city council happens during a city council meeting, and it's the kind of thing where the provision says it should be written advice that's given in order for it to provide any sort of safe harbor for the city councilor. But the city councilor is sitting in the meeting and suddenly goes, I think I have a conflict of interest. Do I have a conflict of interest? And the advice that I give is not going to be written advice at that point in time. It's got to be immediate. It's got to be right there. So by incorporating the written advice provision, we're actually probably negating the entire safe harbor.
At this point in time, unless there are any further questions for these two witnesses, I'm going to close the work, the public hearing on this particular bill. I know there are a number of folks that need to testify. Dave Moss, Chuck Bennett, Evan Boone, and John DiLorenzo. We'd like to have you all come back when we have an opportunity. Everybody have an opportunity to look at the Dash 6 amendments, and we can talk about this bill further. I'm assuming you all can make it back. That's what I thought.
Good.
But that will close the public hearing on House Bill 3328, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 903 and invite Tim Nesbitt and Lisa Trussell to the front. Thanks. Good job. Don't go anywhere, Corcoran. I know you're in a hurry.
No, I won't.
Can you guys stay?
Madam Co-Chair, yeah. Senate Bill 903 limits the eligibility period for emergency unemployment benefits through September 27, 2003. It also increases emergency unemployment benefit amounts from 13 weeks to 15 weeks. You have three amendments, the Dash 1, the Dash 2, and the Dash 3, and I understand there's been some further work on the bill.
Correct. Mr. Nesbitt, take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Nesbitt for the AFL-CIO in Oregon. Lisa Trussell and I have had an opportunity to meet, and as you see, we have a new chart for you. And what we wanted to look at carefully was to try and anticipate not only the pending cliff next week when 9,500 workers lose benefits, but future cliffs and kind of the troughs that might occur as we anticipate statutory provisions triggering on and off and federal extensions. First reducing and then expiring at the end of the year. So we mapped it out for you under current law, and you see that there would be some severe dips in eligibility in terms of the maximum weeks of unemployment insurance benefits available as we look out over the next year. Keep in mind also that no recovery in employment is expected until at best the first of next year, so we're having to try and do our best to maintain as high a floor as possible for jobless workers with these unemployment benefits. Then you see what was originally proposed in Senate Bill 903, what was proposed, which is a little more front-ended in the Dash 1 amendment, so we'd have a maximum of 85 weeks. That would be an extra 5 weeks for the workers you heard from yesterday, those who would otherwise be losing benefits next week. And then you see the AOI version, which I think became Dash 3. And since that was prepared and we looked at it and we looked at the kind of bouncing down and bouncing back up again and would occur under the AOI amendments, Lisa Trussell and I have met and reached agreement on an alternative which smooths out the dips and kind of provides for a more reasonable phasing down to the basic 26 weeks by next June. This would have an additional cost to the UI Trust Fund, not of 75 or 70 million as originally proposed, but of 43.7 million. And we're looking at margins that would otherwise trigger a rate reduction or a rate increase, as indicated in the last row on the chart. So we're well within the parameters for saying we're safely below what could possibly trigger an employer rate increase. And we're also so far above what would trigger a decrease that, you know, it's right there, mid-range, shouldn't affect rates in 04 or 05. And there is a sense of urgency to this because, as you heard, 9,500 workers lose benefits next week. Another program expires June 30th. So we're hoping you could just do a quick hand engrossing of the Dash 1 and add the Dash 2. And we'd be off and running. Thank you very much.
Ms. Trussell, I'd love your agreement on the record as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we are supportive of amending the Dash 1 amendments to February 28, 04, and we're comfortable with the Dash 2 amendments. And again, as our members pay into this fund, our concern is about keeping the fund solvent, as well as appreciating efforts such as you did earlier today with bills like House Bill 3613 that will help provide jobs. That's what we need.
Sarah Beyer.
Thank you. I don't know who the right, hopefully one of you two, if not someone from the department, but the way I look at your new chart, SB 903-1 and the alternate, the far right, are exactly the same except for the what it's going to cost.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the difference is the different cutoff dates that were proposed. On Senate Bill 903, as it's there, we had a June 26 cutoff date. The alternative at the far end that we're talking about today has a February 28, 04 cutoff date. the dash one was May 29th, so that's the difference. And the dash three, or the one that's labeled AOI, didn't include this section in it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Breyer.
I wish to amend the dash one amendments by deleting May 29th, 2004 on lines 2 and 3 and inserting February 28th, 2004 in its place.
Senator Breyer has moved to amend the dash one amendments with the language inserting February 28th, 2004 in place of May 29th, 2004 on lines 2 and 3. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
No, Chair.
Yes.
This is parliamentary inquiry. I think yes. We have to suspend the rules to do a conceptual amendment.
We do. This is a conceptual amendment.
I move that we
suspend the rules.
For purposes of doing a conceptual amendment.
Senator Burdick has moved that we suspend the rules. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Beyer.
You already have my motion.
I already have your motion. We're going to vote on it. Any objection to Senator Beyer's amendment? Hearing and seeing none, it's so ordered. Senator Beyer, you move the dash one and the dash two, the dash one as amended, and the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 903.
So moved.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
As amended.
Senator Beyer has moved the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, Senator Courtney will be the carrier. Thank you.
You think?
You think? Don't go, though. We need you.
Get four.
What?
Yeah, we need to move these.
Tony needs to go.
That's fine.
We need to.
I said,
did you open it?
Measure drafting introduction requests.
Madam Chair, I move the measure drafting requests 1 through 8. Do you want me to read what they are? Periodic review, Commissioner. Okay, 1 through 8.
Senator Carno has moved the measure introduction and drafting requests of 1 from Legislative Activists, 2 from Public Affairs Council, 3 from Public Affairs Council, 4 from Public Affairs Council, 5 from Public Affairs Council, 6 from RPD Government Relations, 7 from the Oregon Land Strikers Contractors Association, 8 from AOI. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Any further business to come before the committee? Hearing and seeing none. We're adjourned. Thanks.
Do you have a 10 p.m. meeting?
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
That's why we're hurrying.
That's what.